Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on the data networking industry where real engineers get together to talk networking. This is a place where we can talk so fast that you can't even hear what we're saying because we're using multiple lanes for conversation. Isochronous Ethernet for the win. Excited? Of course you are. When real engineers get together to talk nerdy, we don't have to apologize for talking technical, for waving our hands at the virtual whiteboard, breathing exhaust air off the core switch, or even to pretend that we know what all the technical discussion is about. Today's show is just a couple of guys out of the IRC channel who had some questions about their careers. So Julio and John are joining us. Yes, it's a special place where we never have to apologize that you, dear listener, don't know what a packet or a router is. It's special here in our virtual boardroom where we gather to wave our hands at the virtual whiteboard, breathe rarefied air, and discuss technical topics that we care about. Today's show is a community show, and what I've done is in the IRC channel for Packet Pushers, and I was recently chatting backwards and forwards with a couple of guys there about some career questions. And what I did was said, why don't we just get together and talk them through, because the questions are fairly, well, they often repeat and they're often reasonably similar. And joining us today is Giulio Ciappini. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I'm from Italy and I've been working in networking for the past 2 years in a very small bar. I work mostly in the SMB space.
Perfect. So you would be like a lot of people who've just started out in the industry and just starting to get their feet underneath them, and you wonder where does it go from here?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and also joining us today is John Garrison. John, welcome to the show. Tell us a bit about yourself.
I'm a first-year network engineer for a large outdoor retail organization. It's a co-op, and I'm just starting out in IT, although I've been with this company for 15 years.
Wow, so you're a life changer? You've changed, what, from some other part of the company?
Yeah, I was actually a building maintenance technician before, which was kind of a ruse to keep myself as a ski bum. and I got engaged to a woman who wanted 3 kids a couple of years ago, and I knew I had to kind of step up my game and get a big boy job. And so I went to the corporate headquarters of the company and clawed my way through the help desk into the network team over the course of about a year and a half.
Wow, that's an amazing shift.
Yeah.
Do you find, like, I guess as a ski bum, you learned how to spend a lot of time practicing effective laziness?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was a, I would say, three-quarter ski bum and three-quarter kind of building maintenance engineer, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I worked just enough to get insurance. I wasn't brave enough to be a real ski bum and work 10 hours a week.
The thing that I don't talk much about my personal life on the show, but I spent 3 years backpacking around various parts of the world, like Egypt, Turkey, Syria, and then down through the east coast of Africa for a very long time. I was traveling for 18 months, I think, overall. And I took time to live and work in London and travel through Europe and things like that. That's kind of like being a ski bum.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm in my mid-40s. I never quite
remember. How old were you when you did the traveling?
Oh, so for me,
yes,
that's a bit complicated. So I did a university degree in engineering, and then a couple of years into my degree, I got diagnosed with cancer. I stuck out engineering for another year, but then dropped out to take a job so I could chase women and drink wine. Because it kind of seemed a bit more important at the time. But in the end, you know, I'm still here 25 years later. So, I had to wait just because had cancer, I had to be monitored for 5 years or something. So I wasn't able to leave Australia and go backpacking until I'd gotten the clearance from my oncologist. And so I had to go wait until I was 21, backpacked until I was 24 or something like that, traveled around the world.
That's fairly similar to my story. I graduated from college with a degree in philosophy and promptly started doing janitorial and building maintenance work because that's about all you can do with a degree in philosophy. And then I broke both my legs while I was working and decided to spend some time just skiing and enjoying myself, and that turned into about 15 years.
And what about you, Giulio? How did you get to where you are today?
Oh, well, yes, it's obviously a chaotic story, just like everybody else, I guess. I'm from the north of the country, and I moved here in Rome about 9 years ago. Well, I was already working part-time in IT, doing the help desk, of course. I was so young. But then I started a degree in contemporary history, mm-hmm. and I dropped out. After a few loops, fall back again on IT, and then I took my CCNA in late 2011, mm-hmm. and I got recruited by the company of my instructor at the CCNA Academy, and then I started doing it full-time.
So none of us have done anything like a normal way into IT.
Absolutely not.
Well, I mean, I've been in IT for 25 years, I guess. So when I left university with an electric, you know, the only thing I could find was work in computing, but that was a different type of job. That was always where I wanted to be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for me as well. I wanted to get a CCNA since I was 18, mm-hmm. but then I just made a big mistake in university, and then I fall back to my original passion as soon as I got the chance.
Right. So the reason for the show today was to talk a little bit about career development and where you guys wanted to go. And we've got a bunch of questions here that we might just start working our way through. So, Giulio, throw your first question out.
What we discussed in the IRC channel was that when I work for a bar, I work for a bar, and every week is a different project. What happens is that I get thrown in the fire a lot. So it's often a very new concept, new technology for me to face, to learn. And I enjoy the challenge and the discovery immensely. Sometimes I'm worried that I'm not acting responsibly because I'm lending my time to something that I don't have mastered yet. And so am I wasting the customers' money and time? Where is the sweet spot for being hungry for growth and the being responsible to the duties to your customer or to your employers, in my case?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I guess, have you ever managed, are you coping with what you're being given? So they're basically throwing you in the deep end for any project that they've got.
Well, for example, I since November of last year, mm-hmm. I've been deploying UC small business solutions based mm-hmm. on the Cisco offering.
Yep.
And, well, I've never touched any VoIP whatsoever before this. None at all. And okay. I just fresh to CCNA, so.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. One is Cisco's technology, or all vendors' technology, is designed to be installed with the minimum of fuss. There's kind of like an 80-20 rule, which is you can achieve 80% of what you need to do with 20% of the effort, right? It's not hard to get most of the network working. And you can often actually give a customer a solution without actually doing anything too clever. Deploying a Cisco SMB voice solution is actually really quite straightforward because you basically take everything out the box, you plug it in, and you follow some basic rules, and it kind of works, right? You plug the ISDN lines in to get some voice channels, and away you go. It's not.
Yes, well, the one thing that happened to me, there are a few gotchas.
Yeah, there are, right? And that's where the 20% comes in. And the trick is, how much of the complex stuff do you know and understand? Do you feel like you should know the hard stuff? Do you feel like, do you feel like you're not equipped to handle that, or you just feel like you're not doing the best possible job for the customer?
Well, the fact is I don't have any formal education in this field, in the voice field, and whatever I discover day by day. And so it happened that I looked back at some deployment that I did 4 months ago, and I could have done that way better. I'd like to know more because I hate to disappoint the customer, to let them down, even if they don't have the expertise to know that they got let down by me.
Well, it's a good attitude. I mean, you're certainly looking at it from the point of view of doing the right thing for the customers as a moral, you know, as doing something right is right. But your employer needs to be in business as well, and they need to make money to pay for everything.
Absolutely.
So they have to sort of take whatever deals they can get. I guess it's up to you to just keep learning and to keep adding something after a while of developing your technology skills, you'll start to realize actually that things start to repeat. You know, IP hasn't changed much in 30 years, but it doesn't feel like it to you. OSPF hasn't changed much in 15 years, but it, you know, there's been a few tweaks here and there, but it's still fundamentally the same thing. If you had a mastered it 10 years ago, you'd be there. So the first thing to do about this is just to sort of say, I will eventually know a hell of a lot more than I do today. And
yes, absolutely.
You can only do the best that you can do. What I would say is, you know, get it in, get the job done and get it signed off because your company needs the revenue. Do the best job that you can do. Certainly makes sense. And three, try and look for the fundamental technology things. Like, for example, for voiceover IP today, you need to understand SIP. But 10 years ago, yes. I needed to understand RSVP because all of the voice calls used RSVP before it switched to H323. And then I had to learn all about the H323 protocol. So when SIP came along, I got bored with voice and I just, you know, I don't want to learn a third one just for voice. So I don't know much about SIP except it's reasonably structured and reasonably well done. And if you can sort of look at your technology from the point of view that you have to learn, you can only absorb so much on a given day, then, or a given month or a given, you know, whenever it is, then just keep building on that and knowing what you can do. And as long as you can walk out of there saying, this is the best job I've done this time, and then know that you'll probably do the better job next time, but that's like everything. Like, I can remember having an apprentice at one stage many years ago when we used to have networking apprentices, and this young fella came along and, you know, he started, when we first put him on, he would only do simple things and then more complicated things as time goes by. I think you've got the right attitude where you're trying to do the best possible thing you can for the customer, but at the same time, just accept that you can only do what you can do and keep moving on.
So do the best and stop fussing about it after it's done.
Yeah, I think so. If you feel that, okay. I remember working for a hospital and I felt that, you know, I really wasn't, you know, hospitals are serious business.
Yeah.
And you sort of feel if you're not delivering the, you know, absolutely the most perfect computing that you might be affecting somebody's. But the thing is that they wouldn't have chosen you in a way if your company wasn't the best for the job, or if they didn't think your company wasn't the best for the job. So maybe you're the best person for the job, especially because you care. At least nobody else. There's a possibility that somebody else might come in who just doesn't care enough to try that little bit harder. So maybe you're the best person for the job.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, but what I'm afraid of is that my time that I can dispose of as I want because I work for a company that I'm not a partner of. Mm-hmm. I'm often afraid that I'm misallocating. I've been misallocated. My time has been misallocated by my, you know, or either my employer or my customer that asks me some, you know, for something that I can't control.
Yeah, that's pretty common. There's not much you can do about that. You just have to be able to communicate with the people around you. So one of the things that networking engineers often don't do well is you need to be able to say to your boss, I can't do this, or I will find this a problem. It's not a weakness to say, I don't know what I'm doing. It's actually a strength. And if your boss knows that you don't know what you're doing, you know, this is a difficult one, right? You don't want to admit that you don't know enough because he might
exactly.
not, right? But if you do get in over your head, you should be able to go back to your employer and say, I'm out of my depth. I need extra time to cover this. And they should help you with that. It's in their interest to make sure that you do the job that needs to be done.
Yeah, it's funny because it's something like this happened at the, like a month ago. And they have been available and supportive. Mm. And now it's up to me to, you know, to show that their effort has been paid off. It's an ongoing process.
It is, and it'll never stop. If you look at the sort of things that I write about in my blog, that's me going on a journey of discovery about new technologies, you know. Spanning Tree, and now it's Trill, and Trill's got its own proprietary versions of Fabric Path for Cisco and VCS for Brocade. They're things that I know about. But I can remember being in your shoes when, you know, back in 2000 when Cisco started shipping their SMB voice units.
Yeah.
In the 1750. And it was, you know, we didn't know anything about them and we learned it all on the job.
I worked with 1750s. They are still in the field in Italy.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are all over the place, right? They were sold for a long time. But, you know, when they came out in 2000 and the early products and we were being, you know, I was working for a reseller who actually got, you know, training. I was in a lucky position that Cisco wanted to. When the technology was very first released, this voice technology, Cisco spent a lot of money training people because nobody knew. And I was able to get some training on those products before I had to deploy them in anger. But there's nothing like doing it to make you focus on getting something
absolutely.
Done. Does that help? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great help. You know, the problem is here that I don't have really an environment around me because I don't really have any colleague that do my job. So my feedback loop is packet pusher. So these kind of inputs are great.
This is why we do packet pushers, is to try and share this, right? So one of the reasons I do packet pushers, I think I've said this a few times, is I started writing because, A, I had nobody to work with. I was like you, I was working alone, but I was designing. So I often work in a design team, and I have a server guy, a storage guy, application developers, and there's only me doing the network because you can't have a team of networking people for certain types of projects. And so writing it out was my way of asking people to help and to share my knowledge with people who perhaps didn't know as much as me. So if I'd write something and explain it for somebody else, then I could help somebody else. And that was where it started from, was those two things. People helping me and me helping them. And that was really what it was about.
Yeah, well, it changed my work life, for sure.
Thanks. Well, John, you've got a question here about being a first-year network engineer. Fire away.
Okay, as a first-year network engineer in a large retail organization, I'm finding that selecting vendors for projects can be pretty frustrating or challenging. And the frustrating part is often the non-technical parts of the decision. I'm new to the field and I don't have the Cisco loyalty, although I love the company and the products. We have a joke about a neck tattoo in my particular business. And I'm wishing that we could be a little bit more agnostic. And we have pressure from management and sales folks, and it's really hard to make choices efficiently. Currently, we have a project to replace our IPAM, our IP address management tool. I'm just getting hammered from salesmen, and we want it to support, or my architect wants it to support auto-provisioning of servers, and almost everyone on my team doesn't believe our company is ever going to do auto-provisioning, so I'm trying to figure out how I select vendors when I have pressure from many different kind of angles.
Wow, that's a toughie. So there would be a few things in there. One would be perhaps the fact that you may not know a lot about IP address management tools. If you're using IPPlan, you're looking at an open source tool, which is kind of simple and fairly straightforward. Is that how you look at it?
Yeah. And that's what we've been using for... since before I started in IT at this company, it looks like at least 5 or 10 years, and it's done the job. But there's kind of a realization from a few of the architects that we need to do something more robust. My team doesn't really use it. The network team just set it up and kind of administered it, mm-hmm. administrates it. The server team is kind of the customer for that.
Yeah, consume it. So IPPlan is... I'm not sure where it is these days. I haven't looked at it in 3 or 4 years. But it's basically a PHP script and a MySQL database that allows you to go in and say, I'm going to allocate this IP address to this server. And it's more of a documentation system. It doesn't integrate with things like DHCP and DNS as far as I know. Does it do that yet? Or?
No. And the way I got involved in this is the current implementation of IPPlan we have sits on a Windows 2003 server that's about to be decommissioned. And I kept pointing out that, hey, we need to move this somewhere else. And I got assigned moving it someplace. And then I was like, well, if we're going to move it, is this the best thing, the best product to be using? And no one talked about it for about 6 months. And then all of a sudden we got money in the budget from one of our architects to do something better.
Right. All right, so the challenge here is you've got a couple of problems. Is one, you know you've got IPPlan, you know that there's something better, but you don't know what that is. And if you go out and research IPAMs, IP address management solutions, they're no longer actually about managing IP addresses. A lot of them are actually about managing IP and DNS and DHCP scopes as well. there would be a single place where you could, you know, create DNS entries and IP addresses. And then there's DDNS as well. So that in Windows machines, when you, well, in Linux machines, all machines now support dynamic DNS. When they connect to the network and they DHCP, the IP address gets given them, and then they go to the DNS server and say, this is my name, I've got this IP address, can you please put that in the DNS database? Now, when IP plan was originally thought of, it didn't do those things, right? That technology didn't exist. So IP plan was just a way of documenting, for most networking teams, this subnet was allocated to this task. So when you wanted to allocate an IP address, you'd hit a web interface and say, this IP address in this VLAN belongs to this. This subnet has been allocated to the site, you know, in Minnesota. This one's in Rome. This is for the office in Rome. This /24 is the WAN links, you know, that sort of thing. It's just a documentation system. But IP address management has become much more than that now, where not only does it give you IP address management, it can also tell you, integrate with your DNS, integrate with your DHCP, be your DHCP, be your DNS servers if you don't want to use the Windows ones. And that starts to get really complex, because if you're starting to say, well, I'm going to replace my DNS, my Windows DNS servers, well, then the Windows guys will say, hang on, that DNS is part of the Windows Active Directory, because Active Directory uses DNS to walk the Kerberos trust mechanisms. Then you suddenly get into a debate with the Windows people about, can you give away the DNS? The answer is yes, you can, but they might not feel confident about it unless you're confident about what you're talking about.
That's exactly where I'm at.
Yeah. So it comes down to, one of the things that I point out to people is that in networking, there's a bunch of, today we spend, for the last decade, we've spent a lot of time bunging around with forwarding packets, like routing and switching. But the real, and we do a lot of that as networking engineers, but what we do a lot more of these days, and progressively more of, is network services. Once a router is deployed, you know, once we've designed something, we need to do more with it than that. We need to take that router and apply QoS. We don't actually do a lot of routing and switching. We actually spend the most of our time doing firewall rules, load balancers, network monitoring, contract maintenance, you know, code updates, things like that. The actual routing and switching is actually a very small part of your day. And learning things like IP address management is actually means that you have to actually understand DHCP, you have to understand DNS, and you have to understand how they integrate with Windows 2000. I would say that given what you've told me, you know, you're probably not in a position to, you know, you just haven't got the technical width to be able to understand the, you know, IP address management integrates with, you need to think about DHCP with DNS. So maybe start reading some white papers from those vendors. Have you looked at the other IPAM vendors around the place to see what they say about their products?
I've had a pretty good conversation with both the Blue Cat people and Infoblox.
Yeah.
And I think I have a pretty good handle on different products that are available. The question is, do I have enough institutional credibility to talk about replacing DNS or DHCP, or taking it away from the Windows servers people?
Or do you let them run their own DNS and just don't use that feature?
Yeah.
Wouldn't delegation work? I mean, wouldn't you be able to create a DNS, a bind instance that handles all your IPAM? And then the AED DNS will import to the zone. Couldn't be done like that.
But then you're asking Windows Server people to know all about DNS, which they often don't.
Well, if they run the DNS server, I mean, I would expect that they know about it.
Not really, because what they do is they just deploy when they have an Active Directory server. And I'm not going to overgeneralize here, but usually what they do is deploy an Active Directory master, and that runs the DNS and often the DHCP. And no, they don't actually know how DNS works, but they know if they do it that way, everything works pretty well. And everybody knows what DNS, you know, anybody who's in IT knows that DNS is name to IP address resolution, but a lot of server admins don't understand that it's also IP address to name resolution. And they don't understand that there's dynamic name registration is a separate piece of the DNS tech. And they, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that happen in DNS that a lot of people just have never, you know, when you're a server guy, the DNS actually isn't all that a part of your day-to-day life. Your real life is about installing stupid things like Microsoft Word and, you know, managing desktops and getting patches onto my Windows system every 3 days because it keeps needing to be updated and rebooted, you know, and those sorts of things. Every, you know, once a month you have to do a patch round of your servers. Do you have time to learn DNS and things like that? So I would suggest, John, that you need to get together with your architects and ask them how deep into the system do they want to go? How much disruption do they want to withstand? And then you would have to organize a meeting with the server guys and the networking guys and potentially the security guys, because DNS and DHCP is a key part. Like, everything IP address is related to that. And have a bit of a chat to them about what's the impact of changing this system out and does that make sense? And will they support you? Because if you can get them on your side, they'll probably start to help you and advise you on the things that you're not necessarily aware of. A lot of them may have skills in this area, but they're just letting you run with it until you say, I need some, can you, you know, I need more advice and more inputs to make this work.
Yeah, I think the issue I'm having now is the original scope was just to replace IP plan. No one wants to increase it past that.
Because of the issues that I just described.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Blue Cat and the Infoblox, both of those solutions are really expensive. You can spend serious money. Infoblox in particular charges per IP address used.
Wow.
And so you can end up with a fairly significant, I think, yeah, per IP address used. And which makes no sense to me, because that's, you know, and it gets really expensive really fast. So I'm always reluctant to recommend Infoblox because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a really generous maintenance scheme, generous for them. Great product, certainly does everything that you'd expect it to do, but comes with an astonishingly large price tag. It's not a small business type thing. IP plan is really small. It's just a, you know, migrate the MySQL database from here to here, put the PHP front end back on, and you'll be back in business and stick with it. You know, migrate it to a Linux engine instead of a Windows engine might be easier if you know enough Linux to make that happen.
Yeah, when I took it over, that was one of my conditions, is that I wouldn't set it back up on Windows. But the reason we got a little money in the budget was we want to start doing auto-provisioning a server, so it needs to be something that will give out IP addresses, isn't it?
Well, see, auto-provisioning of servers is a different thing, and that depends on what platform they're going to use for the provisioning of servers. If you're talking about using something like Cisco's Intelligent Automation Center, SIAC, or BMC Patrol, perhaps, or maybe something like ServiceNow or Service Mesh, each one of those has a different tool. And normally what you do is you actually just allocate a range of IP addresses. Like you say, this is my server, here are my predetermined VLANs. So the network guys goes and creates a whole bunch of VLANs. And then the auto deployment system is just given a pool of addresses to draw from. And every time it auto provisions, it pulls the next one from the available pool until the pool runs out. That's usually how auto provisioning works today.
Oh.
So you don't need to be integrated with your IPAM to make the auto provisioning go.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So what you can do is go into IP plan and say, here's a /22 or a /20. And that's, you know, whatever your VLAN cutup is. So if you're in the data center, for example, for server provisioning, it most commonly is everybody puts a /24 on a VLAN. So for VLAN, this VLAN number, this is this /24. And so you just allocate that as a pool, and that goes into the provisioning system. And every time they, you know, you say don't use 1 through 5 and don't use 240 to 255, and then they just start allocating from 5, 6, 7. So whenever those machines then auto-provision, so for Windows and Linux, they'll wake up, they'll do a DHCP if they don't have an IP address, if you've got a scope available. Or the auto-provisioning system will give them an IP address. When the machine wakes up, it'll have its name, which will be configured by the auto-provisioning system. It will then register with the DDNS, which will then have it added into the Active Directory tree if it's Windows. And for Linux, it means it can then resolve itself. And then you're in business. You don't need an IPAM integration to make that happen particularly.
Okay, so it sounds like I need to have another conversation with the architect.
Yeah, sounds like, unless I'm missing something and he's got some system which he wants to do, he might be asking for more than he needs. He might not have thought his way through the details there. I know I've done that before because I do a lot of design and architecture work, and sometimes I just say things and forget to think them through. And then once somebody comes back to me and says, does this make sense? I go, actually, no, that doesn't make sense. So hopefully he's a human architect and actually willing to talk to you and help you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's great. It was a shock to everyone that there was any money in the budget for this when a lot of other more kind of operationally sensitive stuff got cut.
Sure. All right, let's move on to the next one. Julio, you wanted to ask a question around subcontracting.
Oh, yes, because one of the plagues of our sector in Italy, in my space, is that we often have to work in very deep subcontracts. It happened to me to work as the fifth level of subcontracting for a particular job. That meant that I had no previous information whatsoever except a one-page Word document with the work scope. And maybe it was, it happened that I had to replace a wick inside a router that was handling the transactions for a full 400 people factory mm-hmm. that had to stop for my work to complete, and all sorts of problems happening because the four contractors above us mm-hmm. failed to provide us with the needed intelligence to actually do the work because the iOS version was wrong. It didn't support the new wick. The new wick wasn't a perfect copy of the old serial, but it was the new one with the new connector. So I stopped a 400 people factory from producing for 1 hour mm-hmm. because of this.
And you know what? This will never change.
Yeah, great.
There's no answer for this. So whether you work for a small company who's subcontracting in as part of a bigger bit, or whether you're working for a big company, and so I've worked for companies where I might be part of a team of 100 people in my project, but over here, you know, some of the big banks, for example, have IT teams with thousands of people in them.
Yeah.
And you're the networking guy who works for the, you know, you talk to the server guys, you talk to the security guys, you talk to the application guys, teams, you talk to the executive management, and then over here is the reseller, and then you've got the outsourcer, you know. Hey, that's the life.
Yeah, well, but the problem is that all these figures were involved, obviously, in this particular case. The problem is that me and the four companies above us mm-hmm. were only covering the actual field work side. The subcontracting involved, what happened, only involved the actual field work. So one company got the field work gig with all the planning and designing on a side with a different contractor.
Yep.
And then they sold the gig to the subcontractor of their choice. And four levels down the line, it's us that doing the job with no documentation and no idea what we were doing.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. I mean, I
that sounds normal.
Yeah, I will keep that. I mean, I still have nightmares about that particular gig. It was 2 months after I got my CCNA. It was quite frightful.
And it doesn't change. I've worked in projects where the scope of works doesn't make any sense, but that's what it is, and you just have to do what you can with it. And I think it comes back to your attitude, which is one of being doing the best you can and being professional as you can. And sometimes you just have to sit there and say, well, this is the box. I can work inside of this box, you know. And if they haven't told you what the box is, then you have to do the best you can with what you got. And sometimes you win and sometimes you don't.
Oh, well, I got something out of that, you know, that gig, that job, because I learned how not to panic because, I mean, it was one of the first high-pressure situations I found myself in. So I decided that I needed to get something out of that experience, and that was to stress a little less on the job, because that's a problem for me, stress, because when you are dealing with the unknown, it can get pretty stressful, even at the field level. Someone on the IRC channels called us the ground pounders, so those that, you know, just go to the heroically in the field and without any previous knowledge and just do the work.
Yeah.
And yeah, it helps, but it can be quite stressful.
It is, right? And that's just because you're trying hard to do the, I think partly because you're trying hard to do the right thing. and you also don't feel in control. And when you get down to that level of delegation, you know, somebody's designed it and the design's been handed off. Someone's created the architect of the project and then they've handed it off. Somebody's designed it, broken it up into pieces. And then somebody else has said, this is the networking part and this is the server part and this is the storage part and this is the WAN part. And then somewhere along the lines, everything starts to come apart. The ITIL process really doesn't work very well because it doesn't join everything together. It doesn't look at one system. It treats everything as lots of little small systems. And then you have these gaps where the systems don't connect properly. And that's a real, and that's just something that will happen all for the rest of your career. The best you can hope for is that you recognize it and you find ways to make sure you don't suffer. So that your personal life, your career, so that if there's a mistake, you make sure you go back to them and say, I have a problem with this, or this doesn't seem to make sense. Or, you know, can you check for me? Be, you know, you've got to be organized enough to raise those issues early so that if something goes wrong, you can say, well, look, I told you, it's not my fault. You know, I raised it as an issue, or that's about all you can do.
Yeah, that's something I still need to master, that kind of foresight.
Well, when you get into teams, you're working for a smallish company. You probably know everybody who you work alongside of, and so you can communicate really easily. When you work on really big projects with, you know, a couple of hundred people in a team, you may only know 15 to 20 people in the teams that you work with. And there's all these other people doing things in the computing system. I once worked in an infrastructure team of 50 people, and I knew most of them, but even then, not even all of them. There was only a few of them I could really know. So you have to be able to sort of say, and this is also a bit of an experience thing, if I do this, this might go wrong. I've either got to cover my ass or just go and get it done. Which one am I going to do? Yeah. You know? And you just have to accept that communication in big teams is hard. And there's not much you can do about it. You'll never get the big picture. You know, you may not get the big picture. You may not get the overall scope. You might not understand why you're doing something. So you just have to rely and say, well, I'm going to go out there. I think John will be able to tell you this from building maintenance, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's a machine that's broken. You know that if you hit it here, it starts again?
Yeah, and a lot of the time, just like networking, turning it off and turning it back on fixes it again.
Yeah, but you're the person who's allowed to turn it off and allowed to turn it back on again. And even if it blew up just because you were that guy, it still wouldn't be your fault because you were the right guy to do that. Who else is going to do it?
I like that attitude, actually.
Yeah. Sometimes you're just that guy, right? You're allowed to make those mistakes because you're that guy. And even if you fluff it, no one's really going to come down on you because you are the person that had been tasked to do the job. They might get angry with you for a bit, and you might feel bad, but that's probably about it.
Yeah, I still have issues coping with it. So when I fail a project, it's still crushing to me because it's something that I still have to learn how to manage.
Yeah. I hate failing as well, but sometimes it's just not your fault.
Well, yeah, and sometimes it is.
Yeah, well, sure. Good answer. Good answer. Yeah, sometimes it is, and that's not a bad thing. So, you know. The only way sometimes that you learn, as they say, is by making mistakes. Unfortunately, in IT, we're not normally allowed to make mistakes in the field, and that's a challenge as well.
I can safely say that I'm lucky enough that I this company I work for, it's small, we are a tight ship, but especially in the early part of my career, the first year when I was still studying for my CCNA, and you know, I was given an environment where I could fail gracefully, and I think that's invaluable. If my colleagues, the people in my situation, manage to find a company that allows you to do that, it's extremely invaluable and something to consider when choosing a job.
Yeah, I mean, you'll find when you go and work in a big company, you think you'll have people around you who can help you and advise you. And then you'll have more of this outsourcing, you know, this issue of lack of communication, because those people will be busy on dozens of projects and won't have time, you know, or they won't be able to tell you everything that you need. That's normal. That's just the way the world works. You don't normally get the whole picture. You don't see the whole network sometimes until you're like, sometimes I'm architecting huge networks, right? But then I don't know what the field guy's doing because I just don't have enough. I can't design every little thing. I can't write the work that you do on the field. I just have to let you go and do whatever you do best and trust that you know to be able to do something.
Has it ever happened to you to design a network and never see it actually physically, you know, never visit the data centers, never actually see the work running, and you just left the project before it actually materialized? Has it ever happened to you?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, constantly. Mm. Yeah, that's happened to me many times in the last 10 years. I built a company who built 5 data centers, and I never saw one of them.
Wow.
I don't need to. It's a data center. It's, you know, if I went in physically, I logged into everything and did an audit of it, but there's no. I sent somebody else to go and inspect the cabling and to rack mount, and they sent me back some photographs and stuff, but that's all you need.
Yeah.
What else do you want, right?
No, absolutely. I did. I was on the other side of that equation a few times.
I have to trust you that you know what you're doing, and that we hired people who knew what they were doing. So I usually take photos of the cabling and of the equipment, make sure it's in place. The cabling's tied in. I get test results for the cabling to make sure that they were using quality cable, and that's about it. What else do I need to do? How hard is it to put kit in rack? I don't need to go and physically inspect it. I mean, I don't want to fly to Singapore for 20 hours and get off a plane, walk into a data center for 2 hours and get back on a plane again.
That would be hard.
My life's too short for that. I have to trust the people who are in the job are doing what they're doing. So just let them go.
Yeah.
You should know. You know best. It's your data center. You know where the cables are. You know how it works. That's, do the best you can, and that's going to work. So, John, you had a question around outsourcing?
Yeah. There's a kind of a big push in many businesses, you know, kind of our size, which is around 10,000 people, to outsource as much as possible. And it kind of moves the cost to a different part of the business. It still generally costs about the same. And right now, most of the stuff I do at work is a lot of the stuff I do at work is changing VLANs and port channels and stuff that, you know, clearly is going to be automatic, you know, within a couple of years, if not sooner. So I'm trying to find out how to get into projects and to learn about stuff that's going to be more valuable long term.
So the way that I did it was I look at networking as a starting point. So go back to the conversation we talked about IP plan. IP plan is a simple web documentation thing. So to understand what IP address management is about means you have to understand DHCP and DNS. And understanding DHCP and the interactions between Windows and the DNS and the DHCP and the network. And once you start to understand that the MySQL application that sits on the Windows server needs a static IP address because the application server on a different, you know, the web front end is calling a static IP address to get to the SQL, then you understand why the application has to have a static IP address in it. And then you can say to the developer, well, why don't you put a DNS name in there? So then you've got to think about why a DNS name would be a bad idea. So if the IP address changed, the local machine might cache the DNS for 15 minutes. Are you now a networking guy, or are you a server guy, or are you an application guy, or are you just doing networking-specific things that offers advice? If I look at that, I see you as being somebody who can make the network useful by understanding everything about the network. You need to understand IP, and sure, you need to understand OSPF and spanning tree and VLANs and trunks and, you know, dynamic trunk protocols and all that sort of stuff, but that's not what makes the business money. The thing that makes you stand out is when the application guy says, how do I make my MySQL server highly available? Is there something in the network? And you say, sure, we could do database sharding with a load balancer. And so if this one fails, then this one, and then you do some sync between the two, and you could have a highly available system. At that point, you're an architect.
So what's the strategy to get into more interesting and more valuable projects?
Throw yourself in. So if there's a conversation around, you know, Windows going on, listen, tune into it, sit in project meetings where they talk about these things and try and absorb information about the bigger picture. And then when they throw something up, start to think about how that works in the network. So if you're doing QoS on the network and you're prioritizing SQL traffic, well, why? Why are you prioritizing SQL behind voice? What's the difference between those traffic types? and then try and research why voice traffic needs to be a higher priority than SQL traffic. What's the motivation behind those? And the answer is that voice uses very little bandwidth, but is very latency sensitive, so you need to put that ahead of SQL. SQL is mission critical. That is, the response time of the SQL might be the key application for your business. You know, it might be presenting data to a website that where they sell stuff, but you need to have the voice going as well. So you need to understand the business part, understand where the money... I think you'd know a lot of this already from your maintenance thing. There's some machines that are really important, but only important when they're not running, like email. Yeah. Nobody minds if they go down for half an hour, but if they're down for more than that, then it's a really big problem, like the heating in winter. Right? Nobody notices for half an hour. When it gets cold, everybody notices. It's just that balance between knowing networking isn't enough to be... If you're a car mechanic, and you might be the smartest car mechanic in the world, but that's not going to get you the maximum amount of business. You need also to be nice to your customers. So when this person walks into your garage and says, "Why are wheels round?" you don't just shake your head and chuck a hissy fit and storm off saying, "This idiot's in my workshop." You talk to the person and you help them understand, you know, as somebody once said that, no, I can't say that. It's a dirty joke. You know, you've got to find a way to communicate what you know to people in such a way that they can consume it. So my way of doing that is to understand enough about Windows and enough about Linux and enough about SQL and applications. And I've just learned that over the years by participating in projects, listening to what people say and then thinking about it and maybe doing some reading off the topic where it makes sense to do so.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like, how did you know about how to fix a certain machine when you were in building maintenance? You just did it, really.
Yeah, I took it apart and figured it out.
Yeah, same thing. That's exactly what you're going to do here. Try and throw yourself like this IPAM thing. Go and talk to the server guys about what it is that they do with their data, and you'll learn something about that process. And then if you got into the auto-provisioning, when you say to the architect, well, what do you mean by auto-provisioning? He'll start talking to you about it. You make some notes and then go and think about what that means and research those ideas and see if you can grok onto those. It's about all I can say.
Got it.
Okay, Julia, one last question.
Yes. This kind of links back to what you were saying with John, because my question is, I work for a small company, and, well, it happens that I need to dabble in help desk and some sort of system engineering as well. I had to deploy ESXi hosts, and even Windows machines, Windows systems, servers, and desktops. When something like that happens, do I have to be overly selective of this kind of experiences? I mean, just pick the one that really do something new in that area, or just grab as much knowledge as possible? Because my attitude, without thinking too much about it, is to just grab the knowledge, because I enjoy this field too much to not do that.
So there's you already know the answer to this, I think. You need to decide whether you want to move. As a networking professional, you need to know all of your core networking topics. So you need to know things like VPNs and firewalls. You need to know routing and switching and spanning tree and, you know, all those things, right? Yeah. But you're not going to do those. You're not going to learn all of that stuff just by sitting in front of a textbook. It's part of the experience of networking is getting down and doing it to reinforce all that learning. You need to be very concentrated on doing networking if you want to do more networking. But you also need to, like, just in the same question that John asked a minute ago, how do you get to be more useful to people? Which is really what he was, you know, how do I be, as a networking guy, how do I stand up in front of the server guy and be helpful to the server guy instead of saying, I don't know, you know, he's talking a different language to me. How can I help him? He's babbling on about this and that. You need to do some grabbing of knowledge wherever it is so that you can communicate with people. But you also need to be focusing on your networking skills and making sure that you've got total competency there, because when you leave the job that you're in, and remember, you'll always leave the job that you're in. It's only a matter of time. I would always recommend that you look at life as it's only a matter of time until you leave the job that you're in. Because when your boss gets rid of you because he decides to outsource, like John was talking about, or when he decides to, you know, or you decide you want to move on, or something changes in your life that you get more skills and more experience in the companies, or someone comes knocking on your door, you're going to leave. If you don't think like you're going to leave, you'll never be prepared to leave, and you'll end up in a job that you don't like.
Yeah.
It's very unusual for people to find a career that they're going to be happy with for their entire life. So I would say try and focus on your networking. Build that up, because that's got to be your core competency. It's like today I'm designing, you know, I'm lucky enough to be on a company that's designing a cloud. And I'm sitting in on meetings where in one day I'm talking about virtual firewall running in VMs. And then I come out to a meeting to talk about a orchestration tool that'll actually allow us to deploy, to orchestrate VMware's vCloud. So how do we create a web front end? And then I'm talking to the web developers about how the web application should look. But my real skill is networking. But yes, I can do all of these other things. So I would say you need to have that core of networking first to make sure your career stabilizes and that gives you hard skills. So yeah. I have a theory here, right? There's two types of jobs in life. There's hard skills and there's soft skills. Hard skills are conf-t, int VLAN 1, blah, blah, blah. You do these things. And you have a thing. You can take that hard skill anywhere you go. And as long as you have that, anybody will buy you for a set fee per day. Whether they're permanent or contract, it doesn't matter. The second part of this is soft skills. And there's a whole bunch of people whose job it is just to chat to people about stuff. They're called managers, right? Their job is to go and chat and decide whether this thing is being done. There's no hard targets, right? When you configure a network, it either works, doesn't work. It either works well and is finished, or it's not finished and not complete. Whereas for a manager, they can say, nah, it's not finished, but it's good enough. We'll just call it done. Stick a fork in it and we're over it and move right along. So you need to be able to have those core skills. Do the hard skills, get that under your belt, because that will always serve you first. And then keep an eye out for learning these other things, because they will help you as a networking guide to communicate with other people. So knowing about ESXi and understanding how it works means that you can work with a VMware team to help them provide a network that really meets their requirements. And because you can understand their language, you can provide network services to them, and they'll appreciate you for being you. Instead of just sitting in the back room fiddling with MPLS and BGP, you're actually saying, ESXi works this way, and when you do a vMotion, this is what happens, and this is how much bandwidth you need. That's useful.
Yeah, I love the idea that you mentioned a few times on the show, that we are, well, in this case maybe service, but overall business enablers.
Yeah,
I really like that point of view. And so about the other skills, I think the point is I'm dedicating my personal time to the other skills, because I have a roadmap of things I'm educating myself on in my free time, mm-hmm. and, you know, the certifications and all the, you know, our usual tour of duty. But in the company time, I don't really have any much chance to learn something specific to my field, because often the, you know, the designing and the complex stuff gets handed to me already cooked.
Yeah. I think more carefully about this now. I would say in your stage of your career, you need to focus on networking, because you know, when I said to you that you need to move on to the next job's going to hire you because you're a networking expert, not because you know a bit about ESX or a bit about MySQL. The next step up from being your junior level to the next level is your core competency around networking. Remember what I said about making sure you've got one eye on the door. Even if you're not planning on leaving, just you want to think about getting one eye out the door. Yeah. I would focus on my networking, because that's the thing that's going to be useful for you if your company goes broke tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Miss an opportunity to get some good knowledge around what adds, what connects to the network, but I would focus more on your networking skills today and then later.
Mm. Yeah. Lots of food for thought. Yeah, a lot.
Okay, I'd really like to thank John and Julio for coming on the show to tell us, just to ask questions that I think are really universal. I know I get asked them a lot by people when I've been over to different places and talking to people. These are the sorts of questions I get asked, and hopefully by discussing them and just giving you my personal perspective. And at the end of the day, this is nothing but my views. They're no more right or wrong than anybody else's. And I hope that you will add that to your thinking and come up with your own answers to the way things are. Before we go, I've got a couple of things to talk about. Packet pushers will be going to Cisco Live in the US this year in 4 weeks. So if you are going to Cisco Live, try and keep an eye out for us. We'll be attending some of the social media events there, and we'd love to meet up with you and shake hands and say hi if you've got the time. I've also published a book recently called The Ask First Guide to Technical Blogging, and it talks about my process of how to write blog posts. It's sold off a website called LeanPub, but if you just go to my blog at etherealmind.com, you'll find a link off the homepage to go and have a look at it. If you've ever wanted to be able to blog but couldn't quite find a way to get started, because the question that I get asked all the time is either, Greg, how do you write a blog post? Or, Greg, how do you write so much? So what I've done is written a book. It's very short. It's only about 40 A4 pages that just talks about my process and some of the ideas on how you might want to approach it and gives you a method for actually getting through it. So, Julio, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing this week and where we can find you?
Well, we just signed a new project, so I will be commuting between my city and another to actually get things done in this new project. And it will be interesting because it's yet another VoIP deployment, but it's way bigger than the previous ones. So it's going to have some challenges, SIP phones in a Cisco environment, so stuff like that. Very interesting. I'm quite excited about it.
Cool. And people can find you on Twitter?
Oh, yes. I'm on Twitter at ITS_GC. That's ETS underscore Google and
Giulio Cioppini.
Center? Yeah. Yes. Yes. GC.
Hey, thanks very much for coming on, Giulio. I really appreciate you getting organized. And John, where can people find you and what's up with you this week?
Hi. So this week's going to be all firewalls for me. I have a bunch of ASA rules to clean up. It's going to be a little bit shorter week because we have Memorial Day here in the States.
Short week for me as well. I have a public holiday tomorrow, but I'll be furiously writing on some stuff. Well, that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on today's show notes or follow us on Twitter as @packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.